This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and today we have a special guest. She is the author of a book. Who in this country does not know the name Robert Frost? Well, his granddaughter, Leslie Lee Francis, is here with us. And tell us the title of your book.
The title of the book is from the poem, The Pasture, and it's You Come Too, Journey with Robert Frost.
What's it about?
Well, it's just that. My life, as it impacted with that of my grandfather, because I didn't know when I was very young that he was that recognized as a poet in this country. But as soon as I discovered that, then there was an impact from that time on. And it was very natural. And one of the things I wanted to do when I started this book was to round out the figure of an icon, if you wish, as a human being, as a father, as a husband, and the role of women in his life, which I think had been overlooked in the biographies, the many biographies that have been written about him.
I agree with that. Mm-hmm. And you're the only living spokesperson, really.
Well, I'm the only one in the family that went into this in any depth. And I'd have to say a little bit about that when you have a moment.
I'd love to have that. I wondered why you've always been his granddaughter, why you chose this time in your life to write this book.
It had been coming along for a long time. In fact, I wrote another book before this one, which was a more of an academic thing. And it's very important to understand that even though this is a memoir up to a point, there's a lot of research behind it. And I learned a great deal about my grandfather and about his life and his family and so forth through research, because we never just lived in the same home together. It was hard to catch up with him. He was working until his 88th year when he died. And so that we would visit him in a number of different places when he was talking, here at the Library of Congress, where he was a consultant in 1958, and for a number of years, actually, and at his farm in Ripton, Vermont, and a number of other places where he lived, in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and so on. So we'd visit him, but it wasn't the same as really understanding how he came to be a recognized poet.
Well, this is who she is. Leslie Lee Francis is the granddaughter of Robert Frost. She received her undergraduate degree from Radcliffe College and her PhD in Romance Languages from Duke University. And your master's was from Miami?
University of Miami.
Yes.
Actually, where I had the best professor I ever had was at the University of Miami.
Who is that?
His name was Jose Balseiro. He's originally from Puerto Rico, but had studied in Europe and was what I call a true Renaissance man. He could play the piano, he composed music, he wrote novels, he wrote criticism, anything you like, poetry as well.
Well, we should honor him this moment then, because he had a great impact on you.
Your
major were Romance Languages, right?
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
And so that is your expertise. Yes. And you've been associated with the American Association of University Professors,
correct,
in Washington,
mm-hmm,
and we're going to hear more about your life. I was wondering if you would just start by reading a short segment from the book and setting it up for us first.
I can do that.
I'd love that.
One of the themes that let me back up a little bit here, but one of the themes was what inspired me to get into the writing part of it, and that is that I discovered that he was interested in pre-Columbian history, in the Aztecs and the Mayans and so forth. While in high school, he read Prescott's Conquest of Mexico, the history of the conquest of Mexico, and he was so influenced by the fight of the Indians, the Aztecs in that case, in Tenochtitlan, which is today Mexico City, that he wrote his very first poem in high school when he was Mr. Important on campus. He did everything. He was on a football team, basketball team, head of the debating society, and editor of their bulletin, where some of his poems were published, actually. But he wrote his first poem just by chance. It began to come into his head. It's a very poor ballad, but it's about that attempt by Cortez in 1520 to conquer Tenochtitlan from Moctezuma. And he called it La Noche Triste. And as I was going through Spanish studies, I said, how could it be that his very first poem has a Spanish title? And so I looked into that, into Cortez, into 1520, and so on, which fit into my other studies. And so that got me interested in that. And then he went on about the Indians a great deal for the following years. But later, when he goes to Brazil, he was sent by the State Department to Brazil, to São Paulo, to the World Congress of Writers with Faulkner. And it was a new experience for him as well. He said he would never have gone if he'd known the flight was going to be so long. But there he was able to kind of indulge his interest in archaeology and history and pre-colonial history. Then he flew over the Andes and went to Lima and went out to an actual archaeological dig, found something that he took home with him. And that interest has continued throughout his life. That started me. Then he went to Jerusalem on a fellowship to Hebrew University, and that also had a big impact on him.
At what time of his life was this?
This was 1956, I think.
Maybe so 50, he was 56. Then...
Oh, yeah. His wife had already died. It was much later in his life.
Yes.
Okay. And he continued to do things like that through the rest of his life. And so that the Jerusalem thing was what prompted my first article about him, the published article. And I called it The Majesty of Stones Upon Stones, One Civilization Upon Another. And so that, and I had a beautiful photograph of him taken in the walls of Jerusalem. And so that, you know, that got me going on the writing part of it. And so there are a whole lot of other topics that I took up.
The wonderful thing I'm thinking is here you are a researcher in your own field and you come across the first poem your grandfather wrote. And it's like, excuse me, this is my grandfather and it's in my field of expertise. So I think that is a wonderful thing that triggered. Yeah. What a jump start that was.
And the other thing, of course, is I never felt that Eleanor, his wife Eleanor, was properly treated in the biographies. And I know why. Mm-hmm. She was just hard to capture, you know, because she was so much a part of his life that it was very hard to separate her from him. And so I spent quite a bit of time thinking about that. And that one thing led to another about the number of women that were involved in getting recognition in the first place. And he said, later in life, he said, every poem I wrote was in one way or another about Eleanor.
And you say that in the book.
Yeah, and that was important. So I do have one little segment here from the book that deals with that overall issue. I was raised among women. It wasn't part of a plan, just happenstance. Three of my grandparents' four surviving children were girls. Mother became the dominant figure in her generation. My sister, Eleanor, and I knew only a single-parent household, and I, similarly divorced, sought to adulthood my three daughters. Mother struggled financially in significant measure, but not because of a lack of talent or work ethic, but because she was born a woman in a man's world. My grandfather, having emerged into the world of poetry in England and America, found himself no less surrounded by women. Women often were instrumental as editors or simply poetry enthusiasts. A few, such as Amy Lowell, Elizabeth Bishop, Eleanor Fargen, and Marianne Moore, were successful poets, seen through the prism of poetry and its power. The world of Robert Frost reflected that power.
That is so true. There is no other work about him that emphasizes the women in his life as you have done. How do you describe your mother's relationship with him?
My mother was a very dominant figure from the time she was born. In the family, there was a lot of illness. In fact, that whole period in time, it seems to me, illness was a very major problem and financial problems. But my mother was the second child born. The first one, Elliot, died at the age of four. And there was a lot of tragedy, personal tragedy, in the family life of Robert Frost. But Leslie came out, my mother, Leslie Frost, she came out ready to go and very strong physically, which Eleanor had not been. And so she came back from England having already written with and talked to a lot of poets and other people that knew her father. So she was ready to go, and she finished high school in 1 year in Amherst, went on to Wellesley, Barnard, and the University of Michigan, never finished her degree, however, which she regretted later. And so she was on the move from a very young age and very precocious for her age and a good writer.
And a strong
So they had
athlete.
A very strong relationship.
A strong athlete.
A very strong athlete. Yeah, especially at her grandfather had been a very strong athlete also, Robert Frost's father. But she excelled in everything she did, especially athletics and in studies and so on. But she wanted to keep going and have more adventures. And so the book does cover a lot of the adventures in her life. The relationship with her father was always a little tricky because they worried about her all the time. It's what she was getting into and what she was doing. But they understood each other very well. And she typed all of his poems in those early years on a Blickenstrafer typewriter. And that ended only many, many years into his publishing time with Henry Holden Company, but they were very close as long as they didn't live together, you know, because they were both very strong personalities.
Right. I loved this book very much. You come to my journey with Robert Frost, and we are talking to Leslie Lee Francis, the granddaughter of Robert Frost. This is The Poet and the Poem, Library of Congress. And I have to say, it's an action-adventure story because your mother was a risk-taker, and she was a groundbreaker, and she was a feminist, and she started libraries and bookmobiles over the country and was afraid of nothing. Moved you all to South America, to Mexico, right? And she just was fearless. So she comes forth in your book as the triumphant heroine of the story. Your grandmother, Eleanor Frost, was submissive. She was strong in that she nurtured your grandfather. But in her own right, she was really in the shadows, wasn't she?
That's correct. That makes it hard to write about her independent of him. But what I did, which I think helped me a lot in capturing her personality, because she had a strong personality and very opinionated about things. She was an atheist, among other things.
And she was smart.
And she was right. So I'm going to read one little passage about her, if I may. There is no question that Eleanor could hold her own intellectually. She was determined to complete her studies at St. Lawrence University before agreeing to marry the impatient suitor. Early in the fall of 1894, her final year at the university, she was understandably embarrassed when Robert showed up in Canton, that's Canton, New York, in her lodgings, bearing a gift of one of two copies of Twilight, a privately printed small book of several of his poems that included Twilight and My Butterfly and Elegy. Interpreting Eleanor's discomfort as a rejection, she was uncomfortable in seeing him show up like that with that book of poems for her. One, two copies, you remember. He left there rather quickly. It's a long trip over there, and he had to confront her that way and hand her the book. Interpreting Eleanor's discomfort as a rejection, R.F. destroyed his copy. Distraught, he tried to lose himself in the dismal swamp of North Carolina. After several harrowing incidents, finding himself lost and without money, he called on his mother to help him find his way home. Although exhausted and frightened, he was elated to discover that My Butterfly and Elegy had appeared on the front page of the New York Independent, November 8, 1894, where he would continue to publish. Despite R.F.'s dramatic tactics to win Eleanor's hand, or perhaps because of them, she agreed to marry him 1 year later. Actually, it was a Swedenborgian ceremony in Lawrence, Massachusetts. Having completed her degree in 3 years as planned, once married, Eleanor focused her attention on the goals she and her husband had set for themselves to enjoy a life of poetry together. Eleanor had become her husband's number one partner, not as a helpmeet for genius, but as a perceptive ear for the beautiful music of his poetry. He shared with her each poem as it was written, in a practical sense, as he stated, she had a perfect ear for vowel sounds. It was to her the children went for comfort and understanding. She shared with Robert constant preoccupation with family illness and financial worries. Her death in 1938 deprived the four children, especially the more troubled ones, Carol and Irma, the uninterrupted support they needed and craved.
We come away from your book feeling he could not have done it without her.
Yeah.
He could not have done it without her.
And when she died, it was devastating for him. Nobody thought he would survive that, actually. He was paralyzed. But life goes on. He says the one thing he learned from life is that it goes on. The three words describe the whole thing.
But he was different afterwards.
Yeah.
He was.
He was different.
And in raising the children, they were raised in really a kind of very rough and tumble way.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
I mean, it was farming and growing what you ate and living outdoors, a lot of athleticism. But it was a tough childhood.
Pretty tough life.
Yeah.
I think the physical and mental problems were hard for some of the children. You know, two of them had mental problems, and Marjorie died young just in giving birth to a child, and it was a medical thing that happened. So the death and the troubles of the children were very, very hard on the family.
Tell us about how you researched this. I'm thinking of Leslie Lee Francis coming across this poem in her own studies and getting the idea that she will now right some of the wrongs in his previous biographies. And what is the first thing you do? Do you go to his letters? Do you go to the library where his papers are? What's the first thing Leslie Lee Francis does when she says, I'm going to embark upon this great journey?
Well, there are two things. One is you try to find somebody still alive that knew him. That's the first thing you do because you want to catch them before they go.
Did you find some?
I did find some, yes. Just as an example, Stuart Udall would be one. Mm-hmm. Spent a lot of time around Frost. He'd been a student of his and also did a lot to get Frost doing things like being in the inauguration, where I was also there in 1961. He got Kennedy interested in because Frost was going around New England saying, New England isn't dead yet. We've got the next president. He's only a senator, but next president is going to be from New England. And then he'd always say, well, I hope Kennedy will be more South Boston than Harvard. You know, he always made fun of Harvard.
I think we have to tell the audience who may not know is that this was the first time there was ever a poem at the inauguration of a president.
Yep. That's correct.
Robert Frost.
That's correct.
That's
not the last time, but the first time.
The first time. I think that our young people just don't know these things.
Right.
That was a pretty big
deal
for poetry.
Absolutely. And I think he was also a pioneer in the idea of having a resident poet on a campus. That I remember Conant at Harvard had no use for this. He thought, what is it? Who is this man that's wandering around at Amherst and all this? And when Eleanor died, he resigned from Amherst, sold his home, the last home that they'd had together. And if it hadn't been for Kay and Ted Morrison, it would have probably not had as happy an ending as it did. They ended up getting her into the English department. He had a lot of friends in the English department. That wasn't the problem. But Conant didn't.
That didn't work out well.
He was a scientist, but he had to get money from the.
We don't remember. People now, poetry is proliferated greatly, and we don't realize how very hard it was to break ground in academia as a poet. And I think the importance of this book, which cannot be overstated, is that although we've had this idea of Frost as a great icon, presenting great lectures, being extolled everywhere with laurels, your book shows us the difficulties of being in the Department of English, of being respected as a poet, of having his turmoils and problems with some of the academic supervisors. And I think that it really shows us his humanity more than any other book. And I don't think it could have been written by anyone but
thank you for that.
A family member.
It occurred to me in writing this, too, that a number of the critics said that it was his plan to go to England, publish two books, and become famous. I mean, that this was a myth-making process and that he had this wonderful plan to go to England. Nothing could be further from the truth. And I have one other selection that I was going to read that had to do with his decision to go to England.
Well, I'd love to hear about that episode because I think England was very important to him.
It was very important. This section from the book has to do with his decision after he'd become a teacher at Pinkerton Academy in Derry, New Hampshire. The principal thought he was just wonderful.
What year is this?
In 1911.
And how old is he?
1911, oh my gosh, you do the math, 1874 to 1911, he's in his 30s. So I'm going to read this little section here. When the principal of Pinkerton Academy, Ernest Silver, left Derry to head the Plymouth Normal School in the fall of 1911, R.F. agreed to follow with his family. He'd been a very successful teacher at Pinkerton, and he was known in the state, and everybody wanted him at that point as a teacher of English. R.F. agreed to follow with his family. He soon found himself overburdened with teaching subjects unrelated to literature. Also, the living arrangement as guests in the new principal's home was in causing friction. Frost children running in every direction, a kitchen in disarray. Eleanor never liked the kitchen. Night and day. By the following spring, R.F. and Eleanor, we called him R.F. in the family, by the way, not to his face, but about him. R.F. and Eleanor agreed it was time to move away from the distractions of teaching, either by joining two of his students from Pinkerton Academy who had married and moved to Vancouver to write, this was his preference, to move to Vancouver and have be out in the wilderness and nobody would bother him and he could get a lot of writing done. Or going to England, Eleanor's preference. With the family assembled in Silver's kitchen, the toss of a coin came up England. In the decision to pull up stakes and cross the Atlantic, Eleanor could now share with Robert and their children, quote, a life that goes rather poetically, unquote. The excitement of returning to the land of Palgrave's golden treasury and the prospect of living under thatch. Once in England, nostalgia for New England held sway.
Yes, England is a place he returned and had great benefits for him. One thing I really was struck by was his unorthodox approach to teaching. He absolutely despised the rigor of academia and the way things were set out. He really was a renegade.
Well, he was what he himself called ambivalent about college teaching. He wanted to be a teacher. He said, I am a teacher. I like to be understood.
But he wanted to do it his way.
Yes, he wanted to do it his way, but it wasn't that. He felt that when he was in college, he went to Dartmouth very briefly, right after Eleanor said she was heading for Canton, New York. He enrolled at Dartmouth. His family didn't want him to go to Harvard at that point because they thought that Harvard had spoiled his father. That's another story. But he went to Dartmouth, and they were doing hazing, and he was locked in his room, and then he'd go walking in the woods and come back, and the students would say, what were you doing out there in the woods? And he'd say, gnawing bark. He left after 2 months without even telling anybody he was leaving. He just walked away, which was, he apologized for that later, you know, sort of. He had a lot of ideas about education, and when he started teaching at Pinkerton Academy, he started using those methods that he believed in. He thought that the rote memory and the imposition of learning onto students without any time to think about it or to have their own personal response was a mistake. And when he finally did get to Harvard, he and later talked about it, he said, when I was a patient at Harvard. He never finished at Harvard. His mother became ill with cancer, and he went home to help her in running a school that she was running. That's another big influence on him, by the way, his mother, Belle Moody from Scotland. So that was another woman that's had very big impact on him as a child.
What kind of a mother was she?
She was very literary and something of a mystic. She was a Swedenborgian Christian and started reading to him very young. And he was born in California. The husband had a very successful Phi Beta Kappa graduate of Harvard.
That's his father,
yeah,
Robert Frost's father.
Robert Frost's father was a graduate of Harvard, and he, as I say, very successful, and became a headmaster at an academy in Pennsylvania for 1 year and had to have a woman come and help him with the students. It was so much burden for him, and she's the one that came, was sent.
What do you like about this book?
What do I like about this book?
That you've written. What do you like about it best?
Well, I like it a lot because of the interaction between the two Frosts, Eleanor and Robert, and their children. I think that just meant a lot to me to be able to put that into words.
How many months or years did it take to write?
For this book, all my life, really. It's very hard to pin it down because the previous book had been a strictly academic approach.
And we should mention that. That's Robert Frost, An Adventure in Poetry, 1900 to 1918, a very different book. But it's still available. People should know that. And they should also know we're talking to Leslie Lee Francis, Robert Frost's granddaughter. And as we go toward the end of our conversation, I would just like to know what you wish people would take away when they put down this book. What do you wish they would take away from it?
Well, I wish they would take away the fact that he was a well-rounded man, a good husband, a good father, and not get into this whole psychological business that Thompson did in his official biography, which was a real problem for the understanding of Frost since then. There's been plenty written, though. I mean, Parini's biography, there are other biographies that are much more balanced than that of Thompson. So this is one more that I hope will help round out the the personality of Robert Frost. And he was a wonderful and extraordinarily generous man, and not at least bit practical, however. This idea that he had all these plans to make his life what it was, not at all. And Eleanor hated all that public stuff. If she hadn't died, I don't think he would have done all that. But everything after that was sort of a last hurrah. He went to Russia. He went to, you know, he went to Hebrew University. He was here in Washington
after
having
fun.
Oh, yeah, all those things after her death.
And became the poetry consultant to the
library.
Consultant,
all that, getting Ezra Pound out of St. Elizabeth's. All of these things he viewed as an adventure for him, as part of his last contribution. I mean, he was enjoying life. He liked meeting the press, you know, including Meet the Press. And so I think all of that you got to take into account. And his incredible wit. This is something that... It's not the kind of ha-ha-ha wit, but what he always would say was everything that you think has to go through the wit mill, you know, that to come before you
it was very
before
wry,
you put it out.
Right. And I think that what the importance of this book is the intimacy, because whether you planned it or not, it is such an in-depth personal feeling for what how you lived, your life with your mother, how your mother related to her father, Robert Frost, your own adventures as a child. Mm-hmm. It is a human portrait of the Frost family, and nobody
Thank
else
you.
Could have done that but
right.
you.
Right.
So this is a great contribution to literature, and it was worth all those years you put into it. And finally, why do you think he is America's most beloved poet? Why do you think he is our most known, most taught, most revered American poet?
You know, I think there are a number of reasons. One, he was a great craftsman. He went back and read the lyric poetry of Keats in particular and went back to Chaucer. He was crazy about Chaucer. So he was well-grounded as a craftsman in his verse, even those first ones that were never collected, like La Noche Triste. He is one of the great craftsmen. His sonnets are amazing. His love poems are amazing.
And you can't find a lump in any of them.
And his narrative verse in North of Boston is just so dramatic. And even a poem that's painful, like Home Burial, it's the drama of it is powerful. He loved drama. He wanted to be a dramatist, as a matter of fact. He wrote several plays that were not enough to make him into a great player, because he'd say, I start to write a play, and it would turn into a poem.
That's exactly right. But I'm glad you brought that up, because there's poetry in this book. We have to tell people that in this book there are some of his poems, there are some references to other poems. It's a very, very rich compendium.
And on that, I want to just add what really motivated this book from an emotional point of view. It's just the love of books and the love of poetry. So there are other poets in there, and it's the whole atmosphere of poetry and the power of poetry.
On that note, we have to say thank you so much for coming.
And thank you so
this
much, Grace, for having me.
This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. Our guest has been Leslie Lee Francis, who is the granddaughter of Robert Frost and has written a book which is immortalizing him.
Thank you.
The program is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions, post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making this program possible. Funding is provided by the Witter Binner Foundation for Poetry, the Reva and David Logan Foundation, and additional support from Friends of Poetry, Avide Shoshani, Ken McNeil, Candace Katz, and Joanna Howard, and the Potomac Review interns at Montgomery College. Our engineer is Mike Turpin. I'm Grace Cavalieri.